Blog Talk Radio.
I really can't stay.
Okay, you're free to go.
I've got to go away.
Understood, no means no.
This evening has been
super appropriate.
So
but I do understand consent.
My mom will start to worry.
Definitely text her right
and
now.
Will be pacing the floor.
Here's the code and there is the
so
door.
Really, I'd better scurry.
I am gonna stand over
well,
here.
Maybe just a half a drink
you
more.
You are in control of this
the
thing.
Neighbors might think.
Invite them over if you like.
Say, what's in this drink?
Nothing but Sprite.
I wish I knew how.
Just walk right out the door.
Break the spell.
I do know how to spell harassment.
I
hear you loud and clear.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
I'm trying super
I really
hard.
Can't
please
stay.
Just go out, baby.
I'll
just go outside.
Simply must go.
Uber is right outside.
The answer is no.
Seriously, right outside.
The welcome has been.
I'll walk you to
so
the curb.
Nice and warm.
But totally consensual.
But that can be talked tomorrow.
Hopefully not about us.
There will be plenty implied.
Please do not imply anything.
I really can't stay.
Baby, just go out.
Baby
just
cold.
Go. Baby, just go outside.
This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. We should like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila. This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. Regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila. We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack, and hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war. There is no doubt from the temper of Congress that such a declaration would be granted. This morning, Secretary Hull talked with the secretaries of war and of the Navy. Now the two special Japanese envoys, Admiral Nomura and Special Envoy Kurusu, are at the State Department, engaged in conference with Secretary of State Hull. Their appearance at the State Department on this Sunday afternoon emphasizes the gravity of the Far Eastern situation, where hostilities now seem to be actually opening over the whole South Pacific. And just now comes the word from the President's office that a second air attack has been reported on Army and Navy bases in Manila. Thus, we have official announcements from the White House that Japanese airplanes have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii and have now attacked Army and Navy bases in Manila. We return you now to New York and we'll give you later information as it comes along from the White House. We return you now to New York.
We will hope later to be able to bring you direct reports from both Honolulu and Manila.
To recapitulate, the White House reported today Japanese air attacks on the Hawaiian Islands and Manila in the Philippines. Here in the studio with me is Major George Fielding Elliott, Columbia's military expert, who will analyze now these latest developments in the Far East. Major Elliott.
The Japanese appear to be taking the offensive in an effort to delay and impede American operations in the Far East. Apparently confronted with a situation in which there was no escape except war, the Japanese have attacked the main American naval base in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor on the island of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands. This attack is by air and can only come from aircraft carriers, since the Japanese do not have any bases close enough to the Hawaiian Islands from which to launch land-based aircraft. This is a very great risk for the Japanese to place aircraft carriers within reach of the very powerful naval patrol bombers and the long-range army bombers on the island of Oahu. It is a risk which would only be assumed as a very desperate measure, one which may well result in the loss of the carriers that are making the attack, but may also gain for the Japanese important time to carry out operations in the Far East because of damage that they may inflict on the naval base and shipping in Oahu, and thus delay the proceeding of the United States Pacific Fleet to the Western Pacific. That is probably the Japanese object, and we don't know yet what success they've had in carrying it out. They're expecting to take heavy losses, and these losses may be expected. The question is how much delay they have purchased for the carriers that they have risked.
We have been on the telephone with our station in KGMB, which is in Honolulu, and they report to us that the attacking planes number between 50 and 100, that the air raid is still on, and that the anti-aircraft fire can be heard in a steady drone as the attacking planes come in. We received a bulletin just a little while ago which reported that there have been some of these, what Manila Corps, rather Honolulu, calls unidentified planes shot down. And this latest report now from KGMB is all that we have to the moment. We will continue to receive reports from there, also from Washington, on the developments in our relations with Japan, the relations which will tell very shortly the story of what is to happen in the months that are to come. And Columbia will bring you important news bulletins during the broadcast of the New York Philharmonic Society, which follows this program, and will also bring you a summary of all developments at the intermission time. From Washington, the recruiting office of the United States Navy announces that all recruiting centers will be open at 8 a.m. tomorrow. You've been listening to Elmer Davis, Albert Warner, Bob Trout from London, and Major George Fielding Elliott with a review and analysis of the Far Eastern situation. The Wrigley Company has told us that we may interrupt their program at any time to bring you the latest bulletins. But now, we return you to our regularly scheduled program.
7:55 a.m., Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941. Pearl Harbor near Honolulu, Hawaii. Retired U.S. Navy Lieutenant Jim Downing remembers that day as if it were yesterday.
I'd just been married for 5 months. We were having breakfast when the first bombs dropped. We turned on the radio.
Two 200 miles off Hawaii, 6 Japanese aircraft carriers under Admiral Yamamoto had launched 353 aircraft led by Commander Mitsuo Fushida in a surprise attack against the Pacific Fleet. Jim scrambled from his house toward his ship, the USS West Virginia, berthed on Battleship Row.
So the first airplane that came my direction was all drab. I thought it was an Army plane. Then he came flying low and slow. He had machine guns. The bullets went right over my head. That's when the war became very personal.
Simultaneous air attacks were underway at 6 U.S. airfields. The first wave of attack along Battleship Row crippled or sunk the might of the U.S. Pacific Fleet.
We were tied up with the Oklahoma in front of us and the Arizona behind. The Oklahoma capsized and turned over. So here we were with the Oklahoma upside down in front of us and the Arizona burning like a volcano behind.
Jim first boarded the flaming deck of the USS Tennessee and slid down its 5-inch gun barrel onto the West Virginia. Massive torpedo strikes had already sunk the West Virginia into the shallow waters.
I could see the fire spreading toward the ammunition. I took a fire hose from the Tennessee and tried to cool the ammunition so it wouldn't explode because the fire was spreading to everything above the waterline.
Millions of gallons of crude oil from the USS Arizona, Oklahoma, California, and four other damaged or sinking battleships ignited the water in flames.
Oil is lighter than water, so it stayed at the top. And to see sailors being blown over the side into that oily water, sink underneath, come up, and the oil was on fire, and to see their bodies just burn like a human torch, that was the worst experience I could imagine, is seeing those human torches burning. I ran the whole gamut of emotions. The first was surprise. And then there was fear. And it turned to anger that our leadership had let us down. And then there was pride to see our men without leadership instinctively doing the right thing.
As the second wave of attacks swooped in on the USS Nevada, Jim says he felt peace while fighting the inferno.
I felt like, Lord, I'll be with you in a minute. And I fully expected to be. So I had the deepest peace I've ever felt in my life. And I think that was it. I'm going to be with you in a minute.
Jim's faith in God didn't begin in the heat of battle either.
Years earlier, aboard the West Virginia, a battleship similar to this one, Jim lived and worked alongside a group of Christian shipmates.
I was very unhappy, but Virgil was one of this group. Sing a tune, face shining, looked like he's the happiest person in the world. I knew it was Christ in him. I was attracted to Christ because of the quality of life of the guys I saw who were Christians. It was more the battleship West Virginia. Then I gave my life to Christ because I wanted what these other people had.
Then in that crucial hour when lives were at stake, and later when his shipmates needed comfort in death, God's peace led Jim.
I knew many of them that I saw killed. We lost 108 that morning. They went down fighting. They went down trying to protect the ship and each other. I felt like it. Everybody was a hero.
After all the fires were out, Jim rushed to the hospital. Over 3,500 Americans were dead or wounded.
My friends were burned, so I took a notebook and went down the line of these guys in suspension and said, if you give me your parents' address and dictate a note, I'll see that they get it. The main surprise was how optimistic they were. And they told their parents, don't worry about it, I'll be all right. And they knew that George M. would die that night. But I liked their optimism.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
The next day, the United States declared war on Japan.
This was going to be a long war.
Battles in the Pacific theater alone resulted in 35 million casualties, 3% of the world's population. 100,000 civilian casualties at Okinawa heavily influenced America's use of two atomic bombs against Japan to end World War II. Jim was stationed in Washington, D.C. at the war's end, grateful the 400 gunnery trainees under his command would enjoy civilian life once again.
We were relieved that it was over. We were too close to disaster. It must never happen again.
At 102 years old, Jim is the second oldest surviving veteran of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
My main admonition out of Pearl Harbor is, remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert and strong. Because I believe that weakness invites aggression, and we must never be weak as a nation. or aggression will result.
After Jim retired from the U.S. Navy, to his surprise, he met and befriended Japan's Pearl Harbor attack commander, Mitsuo Fushida.
I met him and talked with him on several occasions. A missionary gave Fushida a Bible, and he became a Christian and became an evangelist.
They fought against each other in war, but through Christ, discovered a brotherhood of peace.
I have a favorite verse. Ezekiel 36:23, God himself said, "The nations will know me when they see me in you."
I was a striker, but I was still on deck force. And my sweeper only had 11 men, enlisted men, and 2 officers. The same as any other one. And we were sleeping on the west side of the channel at 12 to 4 in the morning. And I was on the helm steering the ship. At 3:45, he was sitting on the port side on the captain's chair. And when he called Mr. McCloy, the officer of deck, and he said, "Mr. McCloy, we got company. We got a submarine, enemy submarine." And when I went home from the ship that morning, I told my wife not to call me for anything. Because I was tired. I hadn't slept in all night. And she seemed like I went to bed and slept about 10 minutes. And she came to the bedroom and she said, get up, quick. We're being attacked. And I was still sleeping, say half asleep. And I told her not to bother me, that I was still sleepy. And I wanted to get rest. And she said, no, get up, because this is very important. The Japanese are attacking us. I said, oh, no, they can't be doing that. And I finally woke up completely, and I realized what she was telling me. And I went, she said, come on outside the apartment. The whole harbor was on fire, all the harbor. I could see the black smoke from one end to the other because their ships were on fire and burning up the oil. We left and got underway and we let out of the gear and started to sleep when the destroyer come, what I call flying out the harbor. That I had never seen a ship leave the harbor so fast. And the reason for that was a Japanese fighter after it. And he was shooting at that destroyer with all he had, all the guns he had. And the destroyer, instead of going to straight, he turned to us and ran over our cable and destroyed it completely. The Japanese zero was firing at them as we passed their stern, and he almost hit us. It was just a few feet, and because he was trying to get at that destroyer a little bit. I started crying. Not ashamed to admit it. Because the sailors were trying to save themselves and all the dead bodies and the oil, and the ships were on fire and they were jumping off the ships and just trying to save themselves as much as they could. And there were boats after boat trying to pick the casualties up. I always liked the Navy, always. I admired it, and it made me very proud that I had joined. And I still do. To this day, I told them, I'd do it again if you want me.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Witnesses and survivors of the attack remember that day vividly.
I remember the bullets hitting the ground right in front of my eyes and not knowing what that meant.
I turned around and I looked out. About that time is when I seen there were four planes coming at a direct, shooting right straight at us.
Well, about that time, someone shouted, "Dive bombers, dive bombers." The thing that flashed in my mind is that you're a dead man, you're going to get killed. And my first thought then was, "Mother, I'm sorry. I'm not going to make it."
I remember going down to leaving the hospital to the triage area where I was in the morgue, walking down probably 200 yards to the channel, and seeing the desolation and the carnage there. There's still bodies in the water floating here and there, and the smoke and the oil and the grease. It was very depressing. And people cried unashamedly.
We could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of the torpedo. And we took the sight cap off our power scope, looked through it, and bam, there went the Arizona.
1,177 men lost their lives on the battleship, almost half the casualties from the battle. Today, those lives are honored in a national memorial at the World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument, which became part of the National Park Service in 1980. It attracts 1.8 million visitors each year.
When the Arizona Memorial opened, you lined up on the pier in one line while waiting and going out there, especially on the way. And when I got there, I had goosebumps about 6 inches high on my arms.
Yeah, I don't care how many times I go there. When I step on that platform, it sort of breaks me up. Every time. It's just one of those things.
I just think of these guys that trapped down there, couldn't get out, and what they gave up. How they really tried to do their best under the horrible circumstances to help their buddies and to try to save themselves. Just like the song says, "Remember Pearl Harbor." We'll remember.
Powerful stuff. James Bostic here, Conservative Perspective on the Patriot Nation Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com. One of the live shows we do Tuesdays and Thursdays, we do at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Blogtalkradio.com, you look up Patriot Nation Radio, you'll find ACP there. 4 days ago, we marked the 77th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. I've done one of these shows, and I've always had a somewhat historical turn, being a kind of an amateur historian, I guess you could say. And this is, you know, every December 7th, you know, every year that I've done a show, we've done a tribute to Pearl Harbor. I've also done one for Victory in Europe Day, for the 4th of July, for VJ Day, for the Normandy invasion, the Battle of Gettysburg, a lot of different historical. So it's not always just news and commentary, which is what we've had a lot of here lately. But we do historical stuff too. What I would like to point out, these voices that we've heard are from interviews that had been taken over the last 10, 15 years, some of them a little bit longer. All these fellas that you've heard today And we have another clip we're going to play later on. They're not here anymore. They're all gone. They've gone to join their shipmates. And we cannot ever, ever forget. There were some remarkable experiences that day. Yes, it was a day of infamy. It was a day of chaos, of fear, of confusion, of death, destruction. It was a day of anger and fury. A lot of different experiences. The entire spectrum of them, I'm sure, ran through these fellas. And I have a story I want to share with you concerning a fellow by the name of Martin Matthews. Now, here's the nightmare. You are a 15-year-old kid. And one fine Sunday morning in December, you're standing on something called the aft boatwell deck of the mighty United States battleship, the USS Arizona. And off in the distance, you and your buddy, Seaman First Class William Stafford, you hear something that sounds like thunder. You and Stafford, who's an older friend of yours from home, that happens to be a sailor assigned to the Arizona, you're standing there talking, wondering about it, and across the shipping channel, columns of smoke suddenly start to billow up. What the hell's going on? More to the point, what's a 15-year-old sailor, strictly a visitor, on board the battleship to do? See, you'd lied about your age to get into the peacetime Navy girls. You know, they just dug that uniform. Those nearby explosions that you're hearing, those aren't exactly routine. Could it be some kind of gunnery practice? And what about those planes up in the sky, black line after black line heading towards you? Out on the water goes a smaller ship, looks like maybe a destroyer or a mine layer. A bomb hits it and breaks her in half, and that does it. Aboard Arizona, general quarters is sounded. Everyone on board, hundreds of sailors, now run racing pell-mell to their duty stations. Your friend Stafford goes too. I got to go. I'll see you later. And he's gone. Well, sure, buddy or nobody, he's got a battle station to go to just like everybody else. And so, with the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, with the devastating surprise attack on the Pacific Fleet, with all that death and destruction that brought the United States into World War II with sheer pandemonium surrounding you, an explosion rends the ship. Then a second one. The crew runs and screams. Guns start to fire back up into the sky. Your friend's gone. And with all that, you're now standing at the stern of the mighty ship all alone, alone and wondering, can't this please just be a nightmare? But for young Martin Matthews, born in Shelbyville, Kentucky, it was no nightmare. He really was there at Pearl Harbor. He really was only 15 years old at that time, and he really was in the United States Navy. But this was not his normal duty station. No, he was stationed at nearby Ford Island Naval Air Station, also under attack, by the way. And as those last hours of peacetime dribbled away, Martin had been visiting his pal Stafford aboard Arizona the night of December 6th. And after breakfast on that morning, December 7th, 1941, they'd planned to go sightseeing on shore. But first, they took a tour of the mighty battle wagon. And what was one of the last things this 15-year-old said to his buddy? Wasn't it something like, I wish I could get duty on board a battleship? It was the last thing Matthews ever said to his friend, who was among the crewmen killed as Arizona was broken and sunk on that day that'll live in infamy. The fact that the day would live in infamy would be no solace to Martin Matthews as he watched the devastating attack unfurl before him. And he watched it as a boy, none too happy to be there, witness such terrible sights. I think the second bomb that hit was close to the aft deck that I was on, and needless to say, I was petrified. Put it in plain English, it scared the living hell out of me. Concussions from the bomb blast knocked him down a couple of times, and he sought cover. This was not what I went into the Navy for, said Matthews, and it was not what I wanted. Besides, I had no place to go. I didn't have a general quarters station. As chance would have it, if he had to be at Pearl Harbor, he was in the worst place of all. Arizona's death toll was 1,103, and that was more than half the total number of men in the Pacific Fleet to die at Pearl Harbor that day. Matthews didn't stay aboard the stricken ship all that long. He could never be sure later if he jumped or if he was blown overboard, but he found himself in the water at the stern of the battleship, still fully clothed in his dress whites. He swam to a mooring buoy 20 to 30 yards away, as he explained years later in an interview. And there he clung for the remainder of the attack, unharmed, despite the chunks of metal and timber that were flying through the air. Pieces of bodies, too. It was far too much for a young boy of 15 years old to have seen, Matthews recalled. And while the Japanese planes came wave after wave for nearly 2 hours in all, he couldn't very well swim to nearby Ford Island, since the Naval Air Facility was also under attack. Most of the American aircraft over there, he could see, had been bombed and set afire or blown apart. The attacking Japanese, meanwhile, seemed to be completely uncontested throughout the sky. Closer at hand, the ill-fated Arizona was soon in her final moments of agony. There was ammunition and gun lockers and shells and steel fragments and pyrotechnics coming from all parts of the ship, Matthews recalled. It was like a fireworks display. There was a series of explosions. It wasn't just one deafening roar, but there was one decisive moment. Things came to a final one where she seemed like the middle part of her just raised up in the water and kind of half buckled and then settled back down. And that was the end. The battleship couldn't sink out of sight because the water wasn't that deep. But that was the end anyway. Her bridge and masthead were above the water. I remember that after she had finally settled. It was about that time that the attack waned. Young Martin swam to the beach at Ford Island, where for days after he helped clean up the incredible mess the Japanese had left behind. So incredible, he subsequently said, that 3 entire days later, he and his buddies found an American pilot still trapped in his wrecked airplane at the end of a runway. Matthews remained a United States Navy sailor for the duration of the war. He served aboard 8 ships, and he earned a Navy Commendation Medal. He went to college after the war and then to work, make a living just like everyone else, like most. Except that he goes down in history as a Pearl Harbor survivor, one of the youngest survivors at that. And what else, maybe? Well, those 8 ships that he served on later in the war, 3 of them were sunk out from under him as well. Talk about a survivor. We'll be back with more of ACP, our Pearl Harbor tribute show, right after this.
When Madame Pompadour was on a ballroom floor, said all the gentlemen, obviously, the madam has the cutest personality. And think of all the books about Du Barry's looks. What was it made of? A toast to Paris. She had a well-developed personality.
Walk in Romeo, seeing Juliet, or Pierrot in Pierrette, or Jupiter in Juno.
You know. And when Salome danced and had the boys entranced, no doubt it must have been easy to see that she knew how to use her personality.
Thank you.
possibility. Unless she's got a perfect personality. A girl can get somewhere in spite of stringy hair or even just a bit bored at the knee. If she can show a faultless personality.
Why are certain girls offered certain things, like sable coats and wedding rings, by men who wear their spats right?
That's right. So don't you say I'm smart and have the kindest heart. Oh, what a wonderful sister I'd be.
Just tell me how you like my
personality.
Baby, you've got the cutest
personality.
This is the G.I. Jive, Man Alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jive. Rootle-de-toot, jump in your suit, make a salute. Voot! After you wash and dress, more or less, you go get your breakfast in a beautiful little cafe they call the Mess. Jack, when you convalesce, out of your seat, into the street, make with the feet. Reach! If you're a PVT, your duty is to salute the L-I-E-U-T. But if you brush the L-I-E-U-T, the M-P makes you K-P on the Q-T. This is the G.I. Jive, Man Alive. They give you a private tank that features a little device called Fluid Drive. Jack, after you revive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. Private tank that features a little device called a fluid drive. Jack, if you still survive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. Soon you're counting jeeps, but before you count to five,
Crippled Man, Crippled Fleet. At Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, rescue and repair parties were just beginning their grim work. Farther around the globe, Japanese forces were now assaulting Malaya, Hong Kong, Guam, the Philippines, Wake Island, Midway Island. In Washington, D.C., the polio crippled commander-in-chief thought better of the opening line in his draft speech. Simultaneously, at the stroke of a pen, became the more suitable suddenly. Emphatic dashes took the place of two mid-sentence comments. The prosaic in world history was changed, too. It was set off by the helpful dashes. Franklin Roosevelt's war message to the Congress of the United States would now open with its famous ringing reference point for posterity, a date which will live in infamy. 33 minutes after Roosevelt delivered his Day of Infamy speech, Congress, with but one dissenting vote, approved a resolution declaring war on Japan. Senate vote was 82-0. And the House count, 388-1. The single nay on December 8, 1941, being that of Representative Jeanette Rankin, who had been one of the few members of Congress voting against war with Germany in 1917. While she had some support in those World War I days, her no vote this time stirred boos and hisses. There was no debate over this war resolution. This time America was angry. The country was unified in its shock and outrage. I ask the Congress to declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire. Roosevelt hardly had to ask. His speech, broadcast live by radio, he appeared at a joint session of the House and the Senate. The cabinet and the Supreme Court were on hand. Millions listened at homes, offices, factories, or military posts. And so on a Sunday morning of 1941, the separate, even somewhat limited wars that had been raging in Europe and Asia became one. With the attack on Pearl Harbor, a hesitant, still somewhat isolationist United States, at last, was pulled headlong into the vortex of violence and destruction. And not only America, in a week's time after Pearl Harbor, three dozen nations, populated by one half the planet's inhabitants, were officially at war. We call it World War II in its scope, in its impact on very nearly all the peoples of the earth. It was really the first world war. No conflict like it had ever taken place before, and none since. The worldwide spread of the war may have happened soon enough anyway, some other way. But in fact, the way it did happen was with the attack at Pearl Harbor. There were loud cheers as each plane rose into the air, recalled Commander Mitsuo Fuchida, carrier-based air armada that struck Pearl Harbor. After circling the fleet formation, we set course due south for Pearl Harbor. Under Fuchida's command, he later said there were 49 level bombers, 40 torpedo planes, 51 dive bombers, and 43 fighters. That was only the first wave, though. Soon our second wave of 171 planes swept in. And sweep they did. Surprised, caught barely awake that Sunday morning, was an American fleet of 70 combat vessels, 8 battleships in port, 7 of them neatly lined up as the famous Battleship Row. Fortunately for America, the Pacific Fleet's carriers were gone. They were at sea. It took less than 2 hours for the Japanese to sink or cripple 7 of the battleships, 3 cruisers, 3 destroyers, while also destroying 188 aircraft at nearby fields like Wheeler, Hickam, and Bellows, leaving 2,403 Americans dead and another 1,178 wounded. But there are still many targets which should be hit, Fuchida argued when he returned to his carrier. His urging of another attack on Pearl Harbor was overruled. Immediately, flag signals were hoisted and our ships headed northwest at high speed. The Japanese lost only 29 aircraft and 55 men at Pearl Harbor, but also, in time, they lost the war. At one point during the two Pearl Harbor air attacks, Admiral Husband Kimmel, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, was struck with little injury by a spent bullet that flew into his office and struck him in the chest. Aware of the tragedy unfolding around him and the blame that would be his, He put the bullet in his pocket and said, "It would have been merciful had it killed me." Kimmel, along with the local U.S. Army commander, General Walter Short, were indeed relieved of their posts. Fuchida, meanwhile, survived severe injury in the later Battle of Midway, which was a significant United States victory, and after the war became a Christian convert, a Protestant minister, and a United States citizen. The average age, the average median age in the United States right now is about 38 years old. 38 years and change. Being in the school business for my daytime gig, I know what's being taught in the history classes. This isn't it. Americans aren't being taught as well that the price of peace is constant vigilance. Like we heard Lieutenant James Dowling say in the first clip that we heard, weakness or appeasement invite aggression. Look at what happened in Europe as Hitler rolled through Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Sudetenland, France, Belgium, Holland, all of Europe, except for the tiny island nation of England. The reason he was able to do this is because the other European leaders, in their desperation for peace and to avoid war, gave the German dictator everything he wanted. It wasn't any different in the Pacific. The United States was insulated from both of these wars due to the expanse of the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. A lot of people have speculated, and the conventional thinking is, and it was a big, you know, I've studied this for a long, long time, that Roosevelt desperately wanted the United States in this war. He wanted to be able to help the British defeat Hitler. There are those who allege that the Roosevelt administration and those in the positions of knowledge knew that this was going to happen, allowed it to happen, which was not exactly true. I think that the Roosevelt administration fundamentally understood that at some point the Japanese were going to have to deal with the threat that the United States Pacific Fleet represented in terms of their ideas of conquest of the Pacific and fundamentally the world. It was Japan's ancient philosophy, the imperial Japan, to bring all the corners of the world under one roof. And that, of course, meant Japanese world domination. Hitler had the same idea. So did Mussolini. But America at that time was safe until December 7th, when all that changed. We thought that the vast expanse of ocean on either side of us would protect us from the horrors of war, and that we would be able to maintain a very narrow course of peace and neutrality. Well, after December 7th, it no longer remained neutral or peaceful. In many ways, I believe, and I'm going to wrap this up because we got to move on to one one last big thing here in a little bit. Speaking of combat, we had someone today with Trump and walleye Nancy Pelosi. Again, just as it was when it was Remember the Alamo, just as it was when it was Maine, just remember 9/11. Remember those instances. Maine Harbor, September 11th, complacency, comfort, diplomatic easement. We can't let those things happen. The times that we live in now, ladies and gentlemen, are no less interesting than they were in 1941. I hope you enjoyed hearing those voices of the survivors. Like I said, these fellas, all these interviews were done 10, 15 years ago. These fellas have gone on. They've gone to their shipmates. They've rejoined their crews. And they now march in the Army triumphant. And I'm not kidding, people. You must never forget their sacrifices. We must never forget their courage to face what they faced. We must never forget their resolve. We must never forget their determination. We must never forget their love of country, because that's why they did it. And the values that sustained this country were the values of those men who were born in the early 1900s, fought in that war, who survived that war. Men like my Uncle Willie, United States Navy, had a thing called an LST, landing ship tank. It's an amphibious type vessel that brought in. It was larger than the landing craft that you see where all the little guys jump out and hit the beach. This was a larger vessel that came in after the vanguard of the advancing forces made their way onto the shore. And they would drop off trucks, jeeps, artillery pieces. Had one of those sunk out from under him, was rescued by a destroyer, had the destroyer founder in the typhoon. Came back home. Married his girl, raised his family. One namesake, James H. Miller. 30 days in the Solomon Islands. No change of clothes. No bath. No clean socks, no fresh drawers, no undershirt, no nothing. I shudder to think what his uniform, I shudder to think what his fatigues looked like when they finally declared the area secure and he could rotate out. Came back home, married his girl, and raised his family. We can't forget these guys. And this is the problem, because the values that were instilled in these men, we're losing every day. Marty Matthews was 15 years old on board Arizona as she took hit after hit. He saw it all. We cannot ever be unmindful of their sacrifices. We cannot ever be unmindful of not only their sacrifices, but their families. All the folks who cheerily went on with their ration stamps, who understood that gasoline had to be rationed, not because it was in short supply, but because rubber was. We had to curtail driving because we had to save rubber. There wasn't any such thing as synthetic rubber in those days. It came from rubber tree plants in South America and in Southeast Asia. We can't be unmindful of the victory gardens, of poor people made poorer because they were giving what little wages they earned, and they were turning over a percentage of it for war bonds, victory bonds. That wasn't that long ago, America. It wasn't that long ago. And look how different a breed of people we are now. Many of us weak, irresolute, uninformed, disinterested, self-involved, self-insistent. The country will never be raised to regain its position of preeminence among nations with this lack in our core beliefs, in our core values of what it means to be an American. Well, it doesn't look like we're going to get to Chuck and Nan and Donnie. Big brouhaha, I guess we'll talk about it Thursday. Probably have some more in it. Got into it right in the Oval Office during a press conference. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the information that I put together for you, and in the order that I put it together. When I do programs like this, believe me, it really is a labor of love, and I try to do my very best to make it as informative and as entertaining, like all the programs that I do for you guys. Man, that's my commitment to you, is to do the very best that I can in terms of presenting the information that I want to share with you, and doing so in an easy to understand and yet somewhat entertaining way. ACP can be heard Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Blog Talk Radio through the studios of the Patriot Nation Radio Network. We also have a live program that goes out through the Talk America Radio Network, talkamericaradio.org. You go there, they have two audio streaming channels, the Liberty and the Justice streams, and you can hear ACP there at various times throughout the day and the week. I'm going to go ahead and close up shop a little bit early tonight. I ask you people, be ever mindful of what those fellas did. We can't afford to forget that sacrifice. Thank you, Penelope. 90 seconds left, so I guess we are done. This is James Bostic. We'll be back coming up on Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. God bless each and every one of you. God bless America. See you Thursday.